Louise Palmer, and I'm from the Urban Institute, which is a policy research organisation based here in Washington, D.C. And I'll be presenting data on dental care access and use for children enrolled in an insurance program called Healthy Kids, which is based in San Mateo County, California. The study findings that I'll be presenting are also available in a policy brief, which I've brought with me, and there are some down here on the front. And it's also available on our website, urban.org. So the presentation will provide an overview of the Healthy Kids program. It will present some findings from a long-term evaluation of the program, and it will discuss policy and program responses in relation to the evaluation results. Just to give you a little bit of background about the dental health care needs of children in California, findings from a recent assessment show that tooth decay is a significant problem in the county. And in fact, by third grade, it affects almost two-thirds of children in the state. And one-third of children have untreated tooth decay. And there are, as you can see, disparities by race, ethnicity, and income level. And in relation to health insurance, for every child without medical insurance, there are 2.6 children that lack dental insurance. So moving on to the Healthy Kids program itself, San Mateo County provides subsidized health and dental insurance to children who aren't eligible for other forms of public health insurance. So that's basically Medicaid or SCHIP, which in California are called Medi-Cal and Healthy Families. Generally, these children are ineligible either because of income or documentation status. And so Healthy Kids covers children in families with incomes up to 400% of the federal poverty level. And by way of comparison, Healthy Families, or SCHIP, provides coverage for children in families up to 250% of the federal poverty level. And for Medi-Cal, it depends on the age of the child, but it ranges up to 200% of the federal poverty level. So as you can see, Healthy Kids does provide coverage up to the higher income level. And the Healthy Kids program falls under the Children's Health Initiative, and this has as its goal to ensure that all kids in the county have health insurance. And the Health Plan of San Mateo administers the program and actually contracts with an organization called Delta Dental to oversee the dental services. If we take a look at the benefits of the Healthy Kids program, it is patterned after the California SCHIP, or Healthy Families program, and this provides a pretty comprehensive benefits package. And for the dental coverage, it covers most diagnostic and preventive services and basic restorative services. There are some costs associated, some user fees involved. For the families, they pay between $4 and $20 for the monthly premium, and that's dependent on their income level. And for dental care, there are a few co-pays involved, but for basic services, there are no co-pays. So the Urban Institute, along with the University of California, San Francisco, Mathematica Policy Research, and Aguirre International, were contracted to conduct a five-year evaluation of the Healthy Kids program. We're now in the last year, and it finishes in spring of 08. It is a multi-methods evaluation, and for this research on dental care, we utilized data on a survey of parents of enrollees, which was conducted in 2005. We also looked at claims data from the health plan on use, and we also conducted multiple interviews with dentists and other key informants. So turning to the results, we found that about two-thirds of enrollees who were enrolled for a full year between July 2004 and June 2005 had at least one dental service. And this is pretty comparable to kindergarten children in California. As you can see, there is variation by age, and adolescents are the least likely to have any dental care services. service use. So clearly there's a good portion of kids that are not using the dental services available to them, and we actually find that dental care is the biggest unmet need out of all the services that we looked at. And the unmet need is measured by the parent report on the survey, which is a measure, it's a question that's asked, did the child need a service but did not have that service? So that was 11.4% for dental care. However, as you can see, those children that are using dental services are going fairly often. In fact, a quarter of all children went to visit the dentist once in a year, but the vast majority, in fact, went twice or more. And perhaps striking are the numbers of children who went three times or even more than five times in the year period that we looked at. So looking at the types of services that children used, most of them were for diagnostic and preventive care services. But again, as you can see, there were many children that had services for more serious problems requiring restorative treatment and even oral surgery. So when you combine this with the high numbers of visits that we found, it really suggests that there's pent-up dental needs among this population, and that the kids, now they're enrolled in the health insurance, are catching up on treatment that they needed when they were lacking coverage. So there's over 30% of enrollees not accessing services available to them, and we don't really have a clear idea of why that is. However, we do know that there's a relatively low rate of usual source of dental care for enrollees. 72% might sound quite high, but when you compare it to enrollees reporting that they have a usual source of medical care, it's usually in about the 90% range. And as mentioned, there's the highest unmet need amongst children for the dental services. It's the highest unmet need of all services. But we found that among those with an unmet dental need, only 8% attribute it to cost, and that's actually a typo on the slide there. It should be 8%, not 3%. And so we're a little bit confused about these findings, and it raised the question, why aren't more children using dental services? And could it perhaps be that it's a problem with capacity, service capacity? So we wanted to look at this issue of capacity a little bit more. And from our site visits and key informant interviews, we found that indeed some stakeholders and families believe that there is insufficient capacity in the private sector to accommodate all healthy kids enrollees. And we probed this question of capacity further and found from our interviews with dentists that those who are not serving healthy kids enrollees are unaware of the program. However, conversely, those dentists who are serving healthy kids enrollees are willing to take more clients. Also mentioned in interviews that we conducted was a belief that dentists might actually be seeing healthy kids enrollees but not billing the health plan because they feel that the paperwork is too cumbersome and the return in terms of reimbursement rates is pretty low for all the effort. So if we take a look at the breakdown of dental users by provider type, we find that the vast majority, in fact, the vast majority of providers seen by these enrollees are private dentists. The 39.1%, the San Mateo Medical Center, that basically represents the public system. And in fact, two individual dentists are seeing more enrollees than all other private dentists combined. We continue to look at this issue of capacity, and Delta Dental conducted analysis of its current provider network and determined that the majority of healthy kids live within 10 miles of a healthy kids dental provider, and that there is a good provider member ratio and also a good availability of offices and providers within the network. a final piece of research that was conducted by the health plan itself. They did a sort of secret shopper piece of research and contacted 21 participating private dentists and found that there are shorter wait times at private dentists than at the public clinics, and that all the private dentists are currently accepting new patients. But what they found, which was quite interesting, is that many of the families believe that they can only go to the county clinics, not the private dentists, because the county clinics are where they're getting their primary care from. And so they think automatically that they're limited to going to those clinics for dental care. So the data I've presented shows or suggests that there is adequate capacity to see all healthy kids enrollees within the dental network, but that perhaps additional efforts are needed to link families with those dentists and to help them with system navigation. And the Health Plan of San Mateo and the Children's Health Initiative has really taken on board the evaluation results, and they've been making some changes to try and improve dental use. They have changed the contract with Delta Dental to necessitate that they send twice yearly postcard reminders to all enrollees to remind them that they have this benefit, and also postcards to new members who have not used any services yet. The health plan and the Children's Health Initiative are also calling members to do a little bit of health education about the need for preventive dental care and regular checkups. And they're also calling members who have not used any services at 6 months to remind them about the need for dental checkups. And just to finish with, we have got preliminary findings in from a second wave of survey results conducted in 06-07, and they're looking quite promising that the situation is improving in terms of increasing usual source of dental care and increasing use of dental services.
Thank all of our presenters this afternoon. I thought it was a very good presentation. I hope you did too. And now I'd like you to raise your hands and ask any questions you might have. Okay, and address your questions to the panelists. So why don't we start with the woman right there?
Two of the organizations in the list, the Matthew Walker Comprehensive Health Center and the United Neighborhood Health Services. United Neighborhood has about six, I think, different clinic sites. Matthew Walker has one large location. But combined, those two account for probably 45% of all patient care encounters, not just in Bridges to Care, but in for uninsured and insured that are frequenting these safety net providers. So it's a very large presence, yes.
There were some more questions. I think there was a woman in the back who I didn't get to. Yes.
The question was how many children are enrolled as a whole. In the Medical Care for Children partnership in any given year, we can have typically 3,000 children that we link with a medical home. I say 3,000. It was as high as 7,000, in a given year. In the past year or two, it's been closer to about 3,000. And for the the Kaiser piece, Kaiser in 2006, served about 1,500 of those children, to give you an idea. Well, you mean in terms of the enrollees? Like I said, if you take 2006 as an example, I think it was about 3,000 children were served or linked with the medical home. 1,500 of those were with Kaiser, and the other 1,500 were linked privately into private medical, physician offices around the county. You mean as far as the cost goes? Well, we have a set contract with Kaiser with an established cost. With our other network of private doctors, we actually have individual contracts with up to 500 doctors around the county. Those are like private doctors that see a small number of patients for discounted rates, close to Medicaid rates, I guess, in most cases, or even less in some cases. So we have many small contracts. I think that the Kaiser is a very substantial partner. I couldn't say exactly the total cost of the private versus the Kaiser piece, but it's a very substantial portion. I mean, a third, maybe 50%. If you base it on just the total number of children served.
Did y'all understand the question? Did everybody else here? In our case, the documentation that's required for participation is so minimal that I honestly do not think that it's a barrier. All of our care coordinators are bilingual. That also helps a great deal. I mean, Spanish and English. And then, of course, we have access to the language line and all those kinds of things. Our clinics accept persons for care regardless of their documentation. Likewise, our hospitals. So it really is not an issue. I hope it doesn't become one. It could. Our legislators, our local county council, have never raised those kinds of questions, and I hope they don't. We really try to take the approach that this is our community. We need to serve these people. And serve them well, and serve them effectively and efficiently as at least cost as possible. And we are really convinced that if you get them linked to a medical home and they stay there for their care, they're going to be better off and the system is going to be better off. I have to say that we're not really sure yet the full answer to all that. We're going to be carefully analyzing the encounter data. We suspect that our people are still bouncing around to clinic. That's our anecdotal experience. We hope that we find that that's not true. The real question is, how sticky is a medical home? This population, in my experience, is that they are very astute consumers of care, and they go to wherever they can go and be seen the easiest for them. So even though they may have chosen this medical home, whether or not they continue to have that same kind of relationship that we expect would be in an insured population, I'm not sure yet. And that's one of the questions we're going to be really looking at the data hard about.
As I am not the program manager and substituting, I cannot address with great specificity your question, but I do know from my experience in talking with the program manager that, like Nashville, we base our participation in the program on income eligibility, proof of employment, and proof that they're it's related to income and eligibility in and resident of Fairfax County. So we're not going beyond and, you know, what's required to just see if a child is uninsured and residing in our county.
I think you're making a very important point. You know, I often ask myself the question, why have we been so successful? And I think we have, and you have pinpointed the success has really been to get this variety of stakeholders to agree to work together over such a long period of time. I think a lot had to do with the original group that put this together. And let me just mention one name, Stephanie Bailey. Dr. Stephanie Bailey was the director of the health department at that time. She now is at CDC as the director of public health practice. I remember very well in the early days of development of this program, we were having a meeting in the boardroom of the local public hospital. At that time, we only had the 330 clinics, of course, the local public hospital, I think one or two of the other clinics, but we did not have all the hospitals. We did not have the people that you don't typically see at the table. And Dr. Bailey just said to the group, if this is going to be successful, then we've got to get everybody at the table. And she just insisted, and there was some resistance at first, because these hospitals, as you know, are highly competitive. I mean, they are really going at it day by day to maintain their market share and to expand it and to get into a collaborative relationship with HCA, Vanderbilt, the Meharry Public Hospital, and then the St. Thomas, at that time it was Baptist and St. Thomas Hospitals, and get all those people around the table and get them to really engage. It took some real leadership, and I think that Dr. Stephanie Bailey was very critical in that. I think also we had the advantage of having another leader there at the table, Dr. Clifton Metter, who had a long-standing history in both camps, particularly the Vanderbilt, St. Thomas, the not-for-profit camp, and in the public camp. In fact, he had formed a partnership called the Meharry Vanderbilt Alliance, which was an alliance between those two large medical schools to work together. So I think a lot of it had to do with initial leadership. And then also we continued to appeal to the notion of a rational system that benefited everybody. But it took a lot of work, and it didn't just happen overnight. And I have to also say, without the local dollars, and you saw on that chart how they started out small but then got bigger, those local dollars ensure the stability of the program. They basically underwrite the staff, which it's just only three people who work at the health department. But they, you know, that's the stability. And so, you know, the group meets every other month. Everybody comes, typically. They stay engaged. And a lot of that has to do with really good staff work to make sure that when they meet, it's productive. And you know, they're really dealing with the issues that these people care about. Now, I also have to say that the hospital participation in terms of those every other month meetings, it comes and goes depending on what the issues are. Because they're not as typically, that's not on the front burner like it is if you're a community health center. But to sum it up, I would just say it really had a lot to do with leadership on the part of some key individuals who were respected in the community, and secondly, the ability of the health department with its funds to keep the financial stability.
Virginia, there's in Fairfax, there's the HCAP system, which is Healthcare Access Program, and all the different public programs, when they come in through the eligibility department, we find out which system they're eligible for. So children that aren't eligible for FAMIS or any other programs that are out there, then we know that MCCP exists.
In our case, our care coordinators, first thing they do is look them up to see if they're eligible for 10 care or already covered by 10 care. Sometimes people find out that's our Medicaid program, that they're covered, didn't know it. I mean, it's, you know, it's just remarkable. But they do that. It's also very important that we document the income because of our Bridges to Care Plus program, where our specialist physicians are giving their time, basically, and our hospitals are providing the care at no charge at all on the request of that physician. We've had one case that was rather embarrassing because the person turned out to have an income above $200,000. So we're real careful at that point. No, we did not. They already had their own existing sliding scale. We really talked about that. You know, at the very beginning, we thought maybe that would really simplify things. But it's very difficult to get that many different organizations to agree to something like that. And so we said, well, let's don't do that. They, right, exactly, right. Well, the way our pharmacy program works is that, first of all of our physicians are very much aware of what we will pay for. And actually, we fill the prescriptions. There's a pharmacy at the health department. There's a pharmacy at the general hospital. And we only fill prescriptions that are on our formulary. And we have, as I said, now a $7 copayment. And that's for each prescription. So there's no limit. If you have eight, it's eight times seven. The only exception we make are for homeless people. We waive it. If they don't have the copayment, then they don't get the prescription. Now, for the Bridges to Care Plus program, we contract with Kroger to fill those prescriptions. We have a real good relationship with them. They charge us the very minimal amount. We pay, I think it's that program is costing us only about $40,000 a year. And when we initially started that program, we thought it was going to be much, much higher than that. And the patients have to pay their $5. If they don't have their $5, then they don't get their prescription. I mean, it just comes down to that. Now, I mean, I hear occasionally about our pharmacists taking that out of their pocket, you know. And that will happen occasionally. But typically, people are able to get the copayment. Did I answer your question? I understand. That is being paid now by the local government. Initially, it was paid by the federal grant. That was the first request we made to our local mayor and metro council. As the money from the federal government went away, you know, and of course, what the federal government money did for us was help us to demonstrate the value of this to the community, and so you know, our local government stepped up to the plate. And once you get money from the local government, at least it is in our case, you've got it. Unless there's a real cutback in government, and then you have to defend your ground. But you don't have to go after it year after year after year. If they have, they have not shared that with us. We are right now, as I said, carefully looking at this data to see if, in fact, the stickiness problem, you know, do they really continue to go to their medical home? We think, based on our preliminary look at the data, and I shared with you some of that, that it is working. It is very difficult, though, to quantify that and tie that back specifically, you know, to your program. As you can well imagine, it's a very complex question. We really are working hard at that, though. I mean, we really think, because we've got 5 years of encounter data for an uninsured population, I don't think that there's another community in the country that has that. Think about that. That's a real wealth of information to analyze to determine whether or not there are specific patterns of care for uninsured persons, and does it vary depending upon whether or not you're, you know, a legal resident of the county or not, all those kinds of things. So we've got a lot of work to do to find out really what the impact is. We think that it is helping. We cannot really tell you that it has made this much of a difference in terms of uncompensated care at this point. We might at some point. Our partners have not left us. I'll just put it that way. You know, they're still with us. I'm sorry, I did not understand your question. Yeah, we simply are in the expense part counting the dollars that we pay to the Nashville Academy of Medicine to administer the referral process and the cost for our prescription medication program that we actually pay, and then comparing that to the dollar value of the care that is provided. And what we do is we ask each hospital and each physician who has provided a service to a Bridges to Care Plus enrollee to send us a HCFA 1500 or the UB92. And so that is, I mean, they bill us just like they would an insurance company, except they're not getting paid. And that way we are able to document. Now, it's based on charges. It's not actual cost, as you would understand. Yes, I'm not certain that there would be any way to really capture that, though. You're thinking like, If this care was not provided, then what would be the additional cost eventually to the system? Yeah, I understand what you're saying, but I don't know how to get at that. I'm just simply comparing our expenses to the value of the care that gets provided at no charge.
Any other last questions? Well, I want to thank you all this afternoon for staying with us. I thought it was an excellent session, and have a safe trip back to wherever you came from. I want to thank all of our presenters and have everyone give them a really big hand.